Begin House Judiciary Committee meeting, March 15th, 1978.
Okay, we'll call the meeting to order. First thing we're going to do is take some testimony, since we have some people in town on House Bill 83. House Bill 83, and then we'll work on the criminal bill. There is a committee substitute by the CRA.
See, where have we seen committee substitutes from the CRA committee before, Mr. Chairman? It looks awfully recent, doesn't it?
Infamous.
It's going to be like on 37th, if the end there, please.
Your big mistake is being so heavily...
Can we come to order, please? Can we come to order, please? Thank you.
I'm Sheila Gallagher, and I'm chairman of the State Local Boundary Commission. Mr. Strandberg, fellow commissioner, is here. We'd like to thank you very much for the opportunity to discuss this bill with you. I understand you rearranged your schedule for our convenience, and we certainly do appreciate that. And I will be very brief, because I know what's next on your agenda. The commission has some problems with the committee substitute for House Bill number 83. I think one of the major concerns we have is that the Local Boundary Commission is mandated under the Constitution with this authority over local government in the state of Alaska. The way this bill is set up, we think in some ways it abrogates that overall constitutional authority of the commission. For instance, the commission, obviously being statewide, must take the interests of the state overall, not just particularly local concerns. And there are times in an annexation or an exclusion petition where the interests of the state do override the particular interests of a local area. And since we are a state commission, we have a more detached, more objective view. We can go into an area, we can look at the petition, we can hopefully say this particular vehicle will give the best service at the least cost and will be most equitable. We do not have, we have the concerns, obviously, we're concerned about everybody's tax dollar, but we do not have that personal, emotional involvement that arises so often in annexation areas where the people are really mainly interested in voting down an annexation because they don't want higher taxes. And sometimes that's not right for that particular area, and I think you all know exactly what that is. When you have a procedure like this, you know, obviously, that at least 51% of the people are against the particular petition, so if the annexation is excluded, otherwise you would have found a local option route. So you know right from the very beginning that there's a dissension in the area. Because of this, we don't really feel that an advisory vote on the question is necessary or even advisable for not only the philosophical reasons I just touched on, but for some very practical reasons. In a lot of the areas where we receive petitions, maybe there are only 10 residents. Well, the way this bill is presently drafted, 10% of the qualified voters in areas put forth an advisory election. Well, the costs of an election are fixed, generally. At least there's always a certain minimum cost, either one vote, 10 voters, votes, or 50 votes. To me, it's an unnecessary expense. There was a fiscal note that was prepared on this bill last year. I don't believe it's been updated, but if I remember correctly, the Department of Community and Regional Affairs estimated there would be at least 6 elections if this bill were implemented a year, at a minimum 6 elections, and they estimated a cost of $5,000 per election. So this is $30,000 added on to the budget of the state for this advisory election. And we don't feel this is necessary, and this is our function. Also, as the bill is drafted, it talks about the advisory election is after a public hearing. Well, after we've held a public hearing in the area, we have a pretty good idea of what the people want and what they think. And I don't really think that an advisory election would probably change the feeling that we had that came out of the public hearing. So I think it's an unnecessary step, and the bill should not be passed. Then the technical questions, not only the fact that 10% creates a problem, but for instance, the way the bill is presently drafted, it talks about 10% of the qualified voters in the area proposed. Very often, we have found at the commission level that the area that is proposed for either annexation or exclusion is not the area that the commission ends up recommending. One of the classic examples of last spring was Skagway, in which they proposed a very, very, very large area for annexation. The commission approved an annexation, but scaled down the area to what we consider to be a more rational, logical size. And so we see problems with this. You would have an election in this very large or perhaps very small area, because it can go either way, and then of having the commission's decision affecting either a larger or smaller area. So for these reasons, we really feel that House Bill, Committee Substitute for House Bill number 83, does not only not add anything to the process that is already possible in the law, but puts an unnecessary expense in the procedure.
Mr. Brown. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I haven't heard the pitch for the bill because I don't sit on CRA. I assume at some later time we will have the sponsor or others remain as a judge explaining what's gone on before. I didn't quite catch what you were saying at the beginning about some kind of implied improper delegation or usurpation of your constitutional authority. Or if that was what you were saying, I don't see how we could agree with you when all that's asked here is an advisory vote. And there's no requirement that you have to, your decision must follow the way that vote goes.
Well, I understand that we could decide either for or against the annexation regardless of what the advisory vote dictates. But as it is now, we do have the authority to request an advisory vote if we so choose. What this bill does is mandate that if this particular petition, 10% petition is received, we would conduct the advisory vote. So in that respect only, it's actually an inroad in the commission's authority. As a practical matter, the Boundary Commission, from the records that I've been able to go through, has never conducted an advisory election, although it has been discussed it several times. In some of the areas that have been proposed for annexation or exclusion, the local governments are concerned have had advisory elections. Seward is an example of that. Petersburg had an advisory election. So very often the local governments have done it, but the commission has never asked for it, but the commission does have the authority.
Mr.
Chairman,
I guess I don't have another question, but just a request to the chair, and that is I hope we see the bill up soon enough so that I can remember what she said when we get to the point of having a sponsor here.
Scheduled tomorrow.
Tomorrow also?
Okay.
I guess that even with my mental problems, that's probably soon enough, I suppose.
Mr.
Decker.
Sheila, do you, just from my own information, without, I'd say, getting in and hearing the arguments for the bill, does the commission hold these hearings where all these people would have an opportunity to testify before the commission?
Yes, we do.
That we're talking about.
We go out to the areas, regardless of how remote they are.
They could personally come down and advise you.
That's right. That's right, and the hearings are advertised. And I can testify to the fact that we've had quite a few very extensive, very heated, and very well-attended meetings.
Well, I'm sure
tonight. Mr. Carter.
So they do have their input.
Question for Mr. Brown. You said constitutional rights. The local boundary commission created by
constitution.
Yeah, they're mentioned because they're in the constitution.
I've been wondering. Is there my education
under the local government?
Local government section.
Is there any other question?
We should have those short form versions of the Constitution without all the long annotations in our drawers. I mean, was it right at the beginning of your drawing?
Mr. Danker,
I think you might have mentioned that, Sheila. The point you were making too is that if maybe 20, 10 or 100 people lived outside, it would cost you sometimes as high as probably $5,000 just to hold this advisory election.
That's right, and sometimes there are large areas proposed for either annexation or exclusion where the territory is large, but the number of voters and residents is very small. So you could have 10 persons, and we have had petitions where only 10 persons or 5 actually live in the area. And so therefore, with 10 residents, one person could petition and could force the state to conduct this election. And that to me doesn't seem reasonable.
Section 12, page 36.
No. Well,
is there further questions? Thank you, Sheila.
Thanks very much.
We'll let the department decide tomorrow. That's okay.
That was our
question. I didn't
know
if you were going to say something.
Okay.
All right, that's it for House Bill 83.
We'll get
to the rest of that. On to sex and violence. Okay. Very young Barry.
Oh, Barry, we've missed you.
Okay.
I missed you.
Thank you.
doesn't look any shorter, but maybe it's only on one side of the page.
Well, it's shorter. How many pages is it?
It's only on one side instead of two pages.
140?
Well, it doesn't make sense.
Oh. Where's the
why is it? Why does he always have that idea? But it doesn't have box.
Where's the beer? I have one of those.
This one?
We've got two.
This one.
One of them.
Yeah,
why doesn't it make sense?
Because we're not done with it yet.
Okay,
there's one. Okay, oh.
Well, these are amendments.
These are all new amendments.
You will find out that they're very.
You want to have a little faith. Have a little faith and confidence here. No,
it's all right.
You I move Representative Elias and Chairman.
Okay, let's really.
Let's call the meeting back to order. Now, what's your.
I second.
Now, however, question. however much I'm making you suffer, I want you to remember that I suffered 12 hours more than you did already. Yeah,
I was here.
And Barry did, and Fred sat in the meeting. Okay, now, here was the purpose of the meeting, was to take our draft and to look at it and say, okay, given, you know, the committee's gone through this thing and you've done everything, and now let's look at this huge monster and see if it all makes sense. And so there was actually, okay, the people that were at the meeting were Joe Balf, who's the chief attorney in Anchorage, the attorney general, Dan Hickey, who's the, we all know, and then Vic Carlson, the Superior Court judge, Brian Shortell is a public defender, and Bill Bryson. I was a defense attorney in Anchorage who testified before them. Okay, so we all sat down, and Barry and I were there. Fred came in part of the time. And we just went through it with the idea of looking at whether the thing was going to work. You know, who's going to prosecute, who's going to defend this thing? Not to debate policy issues about should the committee do this or that. Well, we did debate some of that. The only things that we brought back to you were things that were unanimously agreed on by everybody there that was at the meeting. And
you should have heard all the other stuff.
Yeah, and there was obviously a lot of things that, you know, one side or the other disagreed on, and I haven't brought that back to you.
It was a heavy way to get them off the hook,
but well, you look at the amendments and see what you think.
But who wants to look?
Well, see,
what did you guys do on sentencing?
We didn't go over sentencing. So
good.
All right, see, that's the other thing, Larry. This group didn't go over soon.
What's the drill? What's the plan now?
The plan is this.
I mean, are you going to have another meeting on sentencing with these folks? Or?
No, but I'm going to have another meeting with us because we didn't even quite finish the thing. So we're going to have...
We'll have another sentencing meeting.
Yeah, we're going to have one more meeting to do sentencing because we didn't even finish the other night when we were all strung out there. And, of course, there was the great Dan Hickey fiasco and all that. And the truth is always somewhere in the middle, and Mr. Hickey probably did have a lot of good suggestions, that many of which, if we were in a different frame of mind, he had done his homework a month earlier, we might accept it. So I've tried to, we have been going over his stuff, seeing what might be worthwhile bringing back the committee, and telling him the same thing. The committee has already decided how they want presumptive sentencing to work, and who's first offender, who's second, but in terms of... I think the only thing we're going to bring back in on sentencing, other than technical amendments, just simple wording, is some possible additions for aggravating and mitigating circumstances.
Well, we've got to go on numbers, too, of course.
That's right, but I'm not discussing that with... Yeah, that's up to the committee.
Okay.
And so, all right, this is the list of the things that everybody agreed on. And I didn't...
Was there any agreement that... Are we going to find ourselves fending off amendments from... This corner.
Obviously, that was part of the effort, you know, is to say.
I mean, over and above these.
In the House. I don't know what they'll do when the bill gets
what
to
was
the
this?
Senate.
I heard Pope went off to Anchorage with a work draft and talked to some people or something.
No, we haven't done that.
I know you have a standing request for the work draft to somebody else.
Yeah, and. On the sentencing, to look over the sentencing bill. But.
Have my heart.
Don't worry. I haven't done anything.
I had one question.
Okay.
All
right.
I didn't get recognized.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I
had
on my
that's right. He
a little more of Bill's questionnaire. Once we go through this, now what other review process before we get this bill do you have?
Nothing. In terms of the substantive provisions, the non-sentencing provisions, this should be it. Now, you know, as long as I've got the bill, there's a possibility I'll click up something that was just a mistake and I'll bring it back to you. But it was simple, it would be simply a technical
okay. Also in here, there is a couple things that the committee wanted to change itself that were separate.
That never got back.
That didn't get back in time.
Here, let me just point out, in terms of the, you've got 25 amendments here. I'd say that probably four or five are leftovers from us. Then out of the 20 remaining ones, I'd probably say the 10 are completely just a technical change that don't affect any policy type change at all. But yet, you know,
I was just a little bit disappointed, and of course, I guess you wouldn't have been if I was selected, but we had five members of the ACLU and very liberal type attorneys look at this, and we didn't, I would like to have seen a little more of what I call the middle of the road type of attorney.
I wouldn't feel it.
Really, Joe Balls and Dan Hickey are...
They work for the Attorney General. They come down here.
And it was clear that they didn't agree with him at the meeting.
Yeah, I mean, that was...
Well, I hope you had that exchange.
Exactly. And, you know, it wasn't anything about the... You know, everybody said exactly what they thought. Fred was there a lot of it,
these are just the unanimous...
Let's look at them and see
what they said. For about 20% of the time...
You know, you make your own judgment, you know, if you don't agree, don't agree. I wasn't going to bring something back to you that was you know, that not at least everybody could agree on.
Ed just wanted to keep arresting the Gideons, that's what he wants.
I wasn't going to bring anything back to you that said, well, the committee has already, you know, made a decision. And, you know, real frankly, they brought up some things we've never heard of. Now, part of the problem is that the people who should have reviewed this bill very carefully didn't, because it's an easy job to put off going through this, right? And people like to sit back and snipe at a later date, which doesn't help us any because, you know, other than Fred, the rest of us aren't attorneys and we may not be real experts in criminal law, so we count on public hearings and stuff to bring the problems out to us.
And would he there?
What?
Would he come in during this meeting?
No.
He ate my American I think he was that old thing. He jumped in the air for me. He's still doing all that unnecessary work.
Well, what this committee has done would make Judge Moody happy. We have reduced many of the degrees of things, which was one of his big things. And,
okay.
Terry, in terms of being productive, it was a very productive meeting since I've been reviewing the criminal code, having those people there. So.
I think the chairman is being congratulated for his court, too.
Yes.
Whole weekend.
I could only take
I know
you said all Saturday and Sunday or half the Saturday. The other thing is, these guys are going to come, once they do get down to reading it, they're going to come in and shoot at it, regardless of whether it passes out of here and we say, tell them to go to hell or not. So we're better hearing from them now than hearing from them later and making our decision. Because one thing is that I don't want, that can happen real easy with the size of this bill, is it gets to the Senate and they say, oh my goodness, it needs another year of work. At this point, I don't want that to happen.
Okay, let's get at it.
Wait a minute, I want to say one thing.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I do commend you for your fortitude, and I commend you for your efforts to get input from everybody. I think it's good. I do hope that eventually we're going to get to the point where we stop taking testimony from people and, you know, just do it or don't do it. But don't you think we reach that point?
We have, and I'm going to have to find somebody smarter than me to figure out what to do. I'm certainly not going to spend another of my weekends going over there. I hope we don't have a pre-conference committee there.
If you do, it'll be a policy committee. It won't be us section by section.
No, you know, everybody comes around in a pre-conference. Okay, are we ready?
Yeah.
Let's hit it.
Okay, you got a package of amendments there, and they're labeled on the top by the I gave letters, and they're numbered on the bottom. For example, I mean, like, say Amendment J is three pages. It's J on the top, but number
six. Does anybody want a pop or anything?
We got a Big Mac with cheese.
Yeah,
I guess we got a Coke and a Pepsi. Okay.
All right.
Let's go.
I got an appointment at 5 a week. Are you trying to work that
way? I hope not. Okay. I think we get done. We move. Okay.
First Amendment's wrong, Mr. Chairman.
That kills 5.
Okay. Do you want to be serious about this?
They haven't had the prefatory remarks, but of course what you're trying to get at is that we don't want to accidentally put in all of the common law of crimes in subsection C, page 1, line 25, and I guess that's what the group over the weekend is concerned about.
We're going to have to move orderly, man. So Barry, you explain the First Amendment.
Okay, the First Amendment is on page, it affects page 1 of the committee substitute, and line 25 to 27. It was originally drafted, this is talking about when you're liable for the conduct of another person. It was originally drafted, it said, having a legal duty to prevent the commission of the offense, you fail to make an effort you're legally required to make. Well, the question is, what is a legal duty? Is it something just in the common law? Does it have to be in statute? The group determined, I believe correctly, that it should be imposed by law. The duty should be imposed by law. There should be a specific statute or regulation that says, you have a duty to do this. And unless there is a duty imposed by law, it can't give rise to liability.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Brown.
My question, and I'll just yield to Lisa afterward, is that I don't see the difference. Somebody could argue later that the words imposed by law could also engraft all of the oddball common law duties that aren't intended to be part of the criminal law, as well as the language a legal duty. And that's why.
Then it should say by statute or regulation.
Imposed by statute or regulation.
Okay, you're right.
Okay.
Lisa?
In that case, what duties are imposed by statute?
For example, police officers have a duty to make arrests, to maintain public peace. If you had a situation where you can prove that the peace officer did not make an arrest of a friend with the intent to promote the offense, the peace officer would be liable for the offense committed by the person.
Are you aware of any laws or statutes that impose a duty on me to prevent the commission of any offense?
Well, it would have to be in the criminal code, and there aren't any. We have a statute on aiding an officer in the performance of his duty, but that wouldn't be, it doesn't go as to terms of aiding an offense. I mean, I'm sorry, preventing an offense. There are no provisions of criminal code as to that.
What I'm getting at is that I'm not aware of such things.
No.
Except as they apply to police officers.
Yes.
Maybe we should be specific then.
So well,
a police officer fails to prevent the commission of an offense or something like that.
If someone tells you that they can commit a felony or something, there's something in there where you have an obligation to report.
Report fires, perhaps, yeah, that's correct. You could have, for example, a statutory duty by people working, say, Department of National Resources to put out fires. And they see a friend of theirs starting a fire, and they don't report it, and they intend to promote the offense. That would give rise to liability.
See, the point of this proposed change was that under the common law, you may have responsibilities that do things like protect your children or some thing going back that or like that. And that was not what this was probably directed towards. And the thing was that what was being said is that you have an obligation to do something, people ought to know that they have it.
I think that statute is originally drafted, Terry. It was always my interpretation of the statute that when it said legal duty, it meant the duty imposed by the law. I think it just clarifies it, right?
Yeah. Mr. Carpenter, I move the revised amendment with the language statute of regulation.
Chairman, I'll object for one question.
Sure.
Chairman, I suppose one example of this might be this. The Code of Professional Responsibility of the American Bar Association with a few changes is incorporated as the rules of conduct for attorneys by the Supreme Court of Alaska under the Alaska Bar Rules. I don't know whether the Alaska Bar Rules would be called regulations, but under that code, and therefore under the Bar Rules, an attorney, for instance, has a particular legal duty. That is, if a client comes to him and says, I'm going to commit a crime tomorrow, he has a duty, I think, that's somewhat specifically set out in the disciplinary, the DRs, they call them. To advise him not to act and to advise him of the consequences of his action, and so forth. I don't know whether... Yeah, now that's a court rule. It's not a regulation.
We could add court rule.
I don't know, but it would look kind of funny.
Well,
child abuse, does the doctor have to report? Is he required to report?
I believe there's some reporting statutes.
Yeah, that's in the statutes. That would be covered by the amount that Larry made. I suppose our court rule is all right, because the courts also should have the power to regulate conduct in the court, which would, of course, you know, the crudest need for regulation is to prevent the commission of offenses in the court. I suggest statute regulation of court rule.
Mr. Brown, are you moving this amendment?
I'm suggesting it to the maker of the motion.
Let's add that to the revised amendment. She'll read by statute. That's going to benefit the town. Having a duty imposed by court order or statute of regulation. Put the court's head in the fire.
Court order. Well, an order.
No, you mean court rule. Order is different.
You mean court rule. By court rule.
Court rule, statute of regulation. Okay, so does everybody have the revised amendment?
Maybe that should be rule of court, but drafting can bring that.
All right, is there any objection to Amendment A as revised? There's no amendment. There's no objection to the amendment. Okay, Amendment B. Yeah, this in fact affects two provisions, but I think it's best just to turn to page 7, 1-7 through 9. It's originally drafted, we said murder in the second degree was recklessly causing the death of another person under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life.
That's good.
Yes, and this does not change it.
That's good.
Well, go ahead, Derek.
What the committee determined, I believe correctly, and I don't believe it substantively changes at all, is that what we're talking about here is intentionally doing an act. Under circumstances manifesting that causes the death of another person, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life, that was more understandable to the group, and I think that really does reflect the concept we're making. And again, I don't see it as changing it at all. You have to intentionally perform the act, clearly. And the circumstances, and since we don't specify culpability for the circumstances, it would have to be reckless. So you intentionally perform an act under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to the value of human life. It restructures it, and I think it makes it clearer the elements of the offense.
Well, see, read this differently. See, he intentionally performs an act that results, as opposed to recklessly causes the death. So it's not... See,
why don't we say he recklessly performs an act?
Yes, well, because
intentionally is a much higher form of culpability.
The example being, you shoot into a tent, for example. You don't know whether people are there. I think it's much more easy to explain that form of that conduct is intentionally performing the act, shooting into the tent, for example, under circumstances manifesting an extreme indifference to the value of human life, and saying recklessly causing the death of another person. You are talking of an intentional act under these circumstances. You don't recklessly act. In fact, culpability in the code, you don't recklessly engage in conduct. You only knowingly or intentionally do that.
Mr. Dink?
Well, I just wanted to ask you a little while that thought there, Brown. I think that's the standard first. Let me tell you something. Let's take the firing into the tent.
Mm-hmm.
You said that he intentionally fires into the tent and kills somebody. That's one thing. But if he's out there and he shouldn't be shooting the gun in the first place, and he's firing it around, if he'd been in the tent, he'd shoot into the tent, the bullet went over the fence and went into someone's house and killed him. Is that reckless or intentional?
No, I think it's described by either language.
You think it will cover?
Yeah, he's intending an act to shoot.
Well, it's murder we're talking about.
Yeah. maybe he's not even intending to. I don't think the prosecution would have to show that he intended to shoot into the tent.
That's
just
exactly
that he
right.
intended to shoot under circumstances which, under the decoded version of manifesting and so forth, is under circumstances where it's clear that he didn't give a damn whether he killed somebody or not.
Like, you know, if I get you and my girlfriend my smartphone, and I start drinking and I'm driving 90 miles an hour, I'm in a very reckless manner and I have a wreck and she dies.
Well, that...
I didn't have any intent.
Okay, under either version of the language, that would be a jury question as to whether or not it rises to the level of this formula or whether that's the negligent homicide under manslaughter. And I guess they would look to see how extreme the conduct was under the circumstances.
You don't see any difference in the
Yeah, because that's basically what it is. The intentional element is only going to some act other than a homicidal act, which under circumstances where any fool should realize that it could easily result in death. And the person just apparently doesn't care one way or the other. You can do it anyway. Running over a bunch of people that are lying asleep somewhere, you know.
The way we got into this was somebody bringing up the point is, when they asked Barry, they said Barry was explaining the difference between this and manslaughter. And they said, well, how would you write the jury instructions? In other words, how do you explain to the jury what number two is? How's number two different from first-degree murder, and how's it different from manslaughter? And that was the point. You're going to have to be able to explain what's first-degree to murder, and what's second-degree murder, and what's manslaughter, because the jury, because of lesser included, may find him guilty of second-degree or manslaughter or first-degree, whatever it is, but they're going to have to be able to understand the difference. And after everybody discussed it, they decided that it was real hard the way this was worded with recklessly, and then looking at the definitions of reckless to explain the difference between first, second, and manslaughter.
That's right. Judge Carlson pointed out, said, how am I going to explain that to a jury? And I think everybody felt that concept in the amendment would be more understandable to a jury than as originally drafted.
Hickey and Ball said this was all right.
It was, that's the important thing to point out. Hickey put in a bill 3 years ago to redraft the murder statute, and this is how he phrased it. And the defense, and you know, it was an agreement, again, this stuff was an agreement between the people that try these cases, that this extended to people that...
All right, Bill?
It still seems like we're taking second degree murder, take that language and rewriting that language to fit a manslaughter statute, not a murder second degree.
No, that's not correct. The manslaughter statute... I'm sorry, manslaughter is intentionally or recklessly or knowingly causing the death under circumstances not amounting to murder or in either degree. And you're not rewriting it into a form of manslaughter because it requires not only an intentional type of act, it also requires that it be under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to value of human life. That's the difference. You know, the manslaughter does not require that it be, quote, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to value of human life.
If the jury is not convinced that it's this extreme kind of conduct, then they're going to bring a verdict under the lesser included offense of manslaughter. If they think it is one of these really extreme cases where somebody just didn't care at all whether what he was doing could result in death and any fool should have realized that it would, then they'll call it murder too.
Larry?
Is there a legal difference between the two words, intentionally and voluntarily?
We don't use the voluntary. Voluntarily refers to whether it's an act of some volition. In other words, you don't have a voluntary act if you're sleepwalking. You don't have a voluntary act if it's a reflex. And that's the minimal requirement for culpability. In other words, you have to be aware you're doing it. You have to have some control over it. So the basis for all liability under the code is a voluntary act. So you have a voluntary act, and you're acting, and then intentionally, your conscious objective, intentionally is defined as a conscious objective to cause a result or to engage in the conduct. I don't know if I'm quite answering.
Okay, so the tense, shooting into it.
Yeah.
Are we saying here that the person would not only have to, he would have to have a conscious to hurt somebody in the camp?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. That's the whole purpose of the statute. You have to intend the act. You have to intend the act of shooting into the tent. That's right.
Or some entirely different act that would be just one
just
that everybody should realize could easily or reasonably result in death to someone, and you just don't care. You intend to perform the act. The act is not by itself a murder directed toward any one individual, but the likely result is that somebody could get killed or be killed, but you don't care about that at all. You have a reckless disregard for it completely.
It's derailing the train was another example.
Yeah. So, I mean, maybe nobody will die if you derail the train, but you should realize by the nature of the act that somebody could.
Okay. Prosecute a drunk driver under this?
The extreme case, yeah, when it was really a pretty bad one.
I disagree myself. I think that would be a mistake to argue, to say you can.
But Mr. Chairman, I think in a situation where the level of culpability would rise this amount of recklessness, a proper jury instruction would be that if they find this in a in an extreme case involving drunk driving where somebody dies as a result of the driving, that they, it would be a question for the jury of evidence as to whether it rises the level of murder to or is it manslaughter. And in the appropriate extreme case, it would be murder to under this
depends
language.
On the prosecutor.
Doug is nodding. I think.
Yeah, I agree, Mr. Chairman. I think the classic example would be where if the guy is blacked out before while he's been drinking, and he's a drunk driver, and he's had experience before, and he does it, and he does it in a situation where there's a lot of traffic, and he hits somebody and kills it, it could be second degree murder.
Well, if that's your, you better decide what you want it to be, because this will not allow it to be. The effect of the amendment in that regard is that it will not be second degree murder. If you want the drunk driver, if you ever want a drunk driver to be guilty of murder, and it goes because of the intoxication defense, which we'll get into later on, if you ever want a drunk driver to be guilty of second degree murder, then
I think your amendment will do, right? If he intentionally performs the act, if he intentionally drives the car, and potentially intoxicated himself to the point where he's completely lost control and is not responsible.
Yes, but
for
voluntary
proof that?
Let me ask first.
Just an element of proof is all. I mean,
well,
if you can.
There's a thing in the code, though, that's part of this thing. Is
well.
that we had a section in there that says intoxication as a defense, which we never got to yet this year. But, and what it says is that intoxication is relevant whenever it negates either intentional or knowing conduct. That's what the provision says. The committee felt, I mean, this group that we went to, felt that was too broad, that it should only apply to intentional type of acts, as it does now. The existing provision says when it's relevant to a specific intent type of crime, it should only apply. So it does apply to culpability that's intentional. I could restructure that provision, and I know how to do that.
I just think it does.
As long as we understand it, then when we move to intoxication, we could get that straight. Did your feeling that there are some instances of drunk driving that should be second-degree murder under this formulation?
Yeah, I think they will, even with what you've said about
No, because there's a separate provision on intoxication. When we get to that, we'll amend that to reflect that.
Mr. Brown, I think in a situation where someone has perhaps a history of drunk driving, they have a history of blacking out, this can be brought out in evidence. It's known to be the case.
Yes.
Let me finish. And then they intentionally put themselves in a situation where they cannot do anything but toward the end of the day end up driving to get back home or whatever. That could rise to the level of murder, too, here, even under the definition that Barry's talking about.
True.
Cases do happen like
that. All Barry's saying is that there's another provision of the code that can prevent your interpretation, and that if you want to accomplish that result, if you want to have some drunk drivers prosecuted second-degree murder, you're going to have to change another section of the code because it's presently prohibited.
My argument was I don't think it may be necessary. We'll see it when we get there. In the meantime, I don't think
it's necessary. Before we go, is the way the code's written right now, what problem would we have with charging
that? I think it's best it's vague whether yes. And the important thing is to decide how you want it to do, and then we'll do it. And if you've already made it, I think you've made a determination. You may want to have I think it's important enough that you have a vote on it.
I think the extreme stage should be very good. The option should be very good.
Mr. Chairman,
to
answer at least the question, right? It's going to be hard to prove, but I think it can be proved. You know, it might be difficult to prove if the guy is just driving down a country road. What if he knows it's a state fair under those circumstances and runs over somebody driving in the parking lot? Then it'd be easier to prove. So.
Yeah.
The elements are there.
What's the other bill that you were going to record? You say you were going to tell me something.
No, we'll have to. We'll come to
no,
that.
No, we'll come to it. But as long as I think you've made a determination as to the drunk driver.
Is there a motion?
Chairman, I move Amendment B, all of it, because the second half does exactly the same thing with regard to the so-called reckless assault provision, and I think it makes it easier for the judge to write the jury instruction if that was a problem, but I don't think it changes.
Okay, just to make sure on the amendment, it's the same language on page 9, line 21. It's the same identical language you recklessly causes serious physical injury. It's rewritten in the same format.
Yeah.
And that's on first degree assault.
Before we move on to the final motion to accept this amendment, is there anything you can do with Amendment B to if we wanted to, we could write this so they would cover.
Yeah, but you don't do it here. You do it in a separate provision of intoxication.
Yeah, we're going to bring that section up anyway. And it's back in the package for the we'll remember to take that up when we get to it.
Actually,
would this amendment be written better?
No.
To cover same period as by
the this is, I think, the best, and the intoxication thing has to be dealt with separately.
You can, if you can ever find something that's going to be taken to the Supreme Court, it's going to be murder. If nobody wants to get stashed away for a long time, they're going to litigate any. I mean, that's the problem with our present felony murder, is it's been.
Okay.
We don't have. Okay. Is there any objection to the motion to adopt Amendment B?
Hold on. Yes.
Okay.
We're at both parts.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Right. Yeah. It's the same changes to this to the assault provision, which use that same term, similar phrase.
Reckless assault. First degree assault, page 9, line 21. A3 is identical language to murder. A is assault. Okay. Is there any objection then? There's no objection. Amendment's adopted.
I just want to say it's taken me 2 years, but I think I finally figured out how to deal with intoxication as a result of this discussion. We'll get to it, but I think it's very important. It's
worth it.
All right. No, it's good. Okay. This is also on murder, and this goes back to page 6. Frankly, this is my mistake. This was initially my this was my suggestion when we talked about the body murders.
Well, amendment C.
No, the amendment rectifies my mistake. When we were originally talking about murder, and we said what first degree murder would be, I said, well, we'll bring it back as intent to cause death. Well, I brought it back as intent to cause death, or knowing that your conduct is substantially certain to cause death. Now, the amendment would say the first degree murder is intent to cause death, period. The knowing that your conduct is substantially certain to cause death would be second degree murder. And everyone on the committee agreed that the distinction between knowing that your conduct is substantially certain to cause death and reckless, intentionally doing an act under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to value in life, there may be a distinction, but if you had to bring it to a jury, it would be so confusing and it would be almost impossible to explain. And I think that the amendment is very important, and I did tell you initially that that's what first degree murder was going to be, and I brought it back, including the knowing thing, and that was wrong.
What's the other half of the amendment?
Well, the other half of the amendment just modifies the second-degree murder statute to include the knowing situation. It adds knowing that your conduct is substantially certain to cause death. As originally drafted, the murder in second degree says knowing that your conduct is substantially certain to cause serious physical injury. Again, these things in the murder statute go to the point of making the jury instruct. You know, if there's going to be a distinction between first and second-degree murder, it has to be understandable to a jury, and this goes to making it understandable.
Again, I think this was the same as.
I wasn't there when you discussed homicide. Were they unanimous on this one too? Prosecution and defense guys. Were they unanimous of prosecution and defense guys on this?
Oh yeah, because no one, the distinction between knowing that your conduct is substantially certain to cause death and intentionally doing an act reckless, you know, under circumstances manifesting extreme indifference to human life was so close that. You know,
so we spent about an hour taking examples, and here we had six attorneys sitting there, and none of them could tell you which one was which.
That's right.
And that's you got a problem then. We can't even tell what murder is.
Did this come up at the meeting or was this your
own? Oh, no, this came up at the meeting. Yeah, Brian Shortell pointed out, and then Mr. Hickey agreed on that one.
I think he pointed out that this is how he had it drafted in his bill that.
Slowly but surely, we're adopting his.
Well, not really. not
okay. Go.
Yeah, I'll move amendment C.
Okay, amendment number C has been moved. Amendment letter C. You know, I'll tell you one thing: the criminal code has developed for me. It's developed a twitch in my eye. Well,
you have that too. You must have got it from me.
You're lucky.
The eye doctor told me there was nothing wrong with my glasses. There was nothing wrong with my eye. I just don't get enough sleep.
Sure. Okay. Oh, another question.
All right. Those is there any objection? Hearing no objection, motion is done.
Oh, it shows me.
It's a bad sign.
Okay.
Amendment D.
Now, this is a policy question. There's no question about it. But there was unanimous. There was a unanimous feeling on the commission about this. I mean, on that group about this. This is the issue about an unreasonable belief as to self-defense. Or as to anything. For example,
let me give the example somewhat differently. Police officer comes to the scene of a robbery or something, some crime, and he believes that a felony has been committed which involved the use of violence, all right? But it was an unreasonable belief. The jury finds that it's unreasonable belief. Well, under the code as drafted, he will be guilty of murder. Under existing law, he would be guilty of manslaughter. And the committee felt, this group, I refer to them as the committee, the committee felt that the code should follow existing law here and say that when you raise a defense and you don't necessarily win on your defense, in other words, they find it's an unreasonable belief, it should not get you off the free, it should not get you off completely, but it should negate what would otherwise be a murder down to manslaughter. That is existing law. And again, you have a belief that you have the right to make an arrest. If the jury finds it's a reasonable belief, you will be off completely. It's a complete defense.
If they find it's an unreasonable belief, but it was unreasonable to manslaughter.
Well, no, under the code, right, under the way it's drafted now, if they find that you did believe it honestly, but it was unreasonable, it is going to be murder under the code. This makes it consistent with existing law, manslaughter, and it makes it an affirmative defense. In other words, it says the defendant has to prove this, that he believed it, and he believed it honestly, though unreasonably. And I personally, I think that this is existing law, and that committee felt pretty strongly about this, that that's how the code should be consistent with existing law in this regard.
Where do we stand on the cases? Most of the defenses are when they shoot a policeman or something, particularly the ones that aren't in uniform. They said, geez, I thought this guy was a crook. And that's why when he came to my door, I shot him. He hadn't already been tipped off the cop or something, but he blasted him anyway. And he claims later, said, well, I thought he was, these narcs run around sometimes, with beards. So they shoot somebody, and then they really knew who they were.
Well, then it's not an honest.
Well, who's going to prove that?
He has to.
Mr. Chairman, in that situation, the defense would have to affirmatively prove it, since it says here, if this was adopted, that it would be an affirmative defense, not just a defense. That is, the burden is not on the state to disprove the defense. The burden under this would be on the defendant. Two things would happen. That is, the jury would have to be convinced that it wasn't a lie, that he really did believe that the person was something other than a police officer, an intruder or something. And that would get him part of the way. If they said, well, he believed it, but it was really unreasonable to believe that under those circumstances, even with this amendment, it would still be manslaughter, you see. If they found out, hell, we just don't believe you, we think you did not believe that at all, what you were basically stating, the guy would get convicted of murder.
Well, it found out, it was an unjustified thing. The guy with the several drugs staggered in the room and he shouted, but he thought it was time that he'd been wrong. I think that would kind of cover
exactly
the situation that he proved that he thought he'd been wrong.
In that example that you just developed, would a jury find that that was an unreasonable belief?
Well, let's assume that they do.
Well, let's go back for a minute. What is an unreasonable? Is there a definition?
No.
That's reserved for a jury.
I mean, that's, you can't.
That's what jurors are for.
Yeah. I mean, that's the one of the. You can't.
They can find that it was unreasonable because they're thinking that this guy was coming here to murder them.
And if they do find it's unreasonable, it's a choice between. The problem is, if they only have a choice between finding reasonable or unreasonable, it puts them in a very strange position because they're either going to put the guy, they're either going to find guilty of first-degree murder, which is a 20-year max, a 20-year minimum sentence now.
Or just not guilty.
Or let him walk completely.
Yeah.
This says, in a sense, you could find him guilty, but not as guilty as, his first-degree murder, which would be the A felony situation.
The amendment gives the jury the middle choice of manslaughter.
They don't work that way. They say, you have to raise a reasonable doubt.
No, that's important. It's an
affirmative defense.
He has to prove it. That's the
reasonable doubt.
No, he has to prove it by preponderance of the evidence.
Preponderance.
Yes, that's the important distinction here. It is not like you're requiring...
The defense attorney in every case will try to prove that the two elements by a preponderance of the doubt, that is, that the guy really believed it and that the belief was reasonable.
Right.
The jury would have to find both elements in order to let him off completely, and would have to find that one was not there, that is the reasonability, in order to find him guilty of manslaughter. and or just basically find that the defense had not prevailed in Curtis.
You don't see this as a big loophole.
Okay, this makes it existing law.
All right. Yeah, and this, we have never discussed this in this committee because it wasn't in the draft that was submitted to the legislature by the commission. Although the commission considered it and did exclude it on a narrow vote. And Mr. Hickey supported it because it was in his original bill, too, and it was existing law. Many of the recommendations that we received were, you know, why are you changing existing law when there's not been a problem? You know, and they argued that on several things, and we'll get to some more today that are arguments made. Mr. Cartman.
They would have constituted a justification for killing under Chapter 81, 300.
Yeah. That's the sections on use of non-deadly force and use of force in defense of self, use of force by a peace officer in making an arrest, defense of property, all the sections on when you can use force.
Yeah. Remember, we basically said people could use force in most cases the same way that a police officer can.
So really, this additional affirmative defense gives me the option to take my attacking self-defense even if I'm
unreasonable. Yeah. You really believe that even if it was unreasonable.
Yeah, but the distinction is that you're not going to get off. You're going to be, you're not going to be found guilty of murder, you'll be found guilty of manslaughter.
Well, it could also go the other way. I mean, it could go that you're not going to get convicted.
No, because this only says you raise it. Okay, number one, you raise a defense, that is self-defense. The jury finds it was reasonable, you're off. Because that's how it's always been.
They find that it's unreasonable.
Then you're guilty of manslaughter. Then you're guilty of manslaughter.
No, but I mean, whereas before that you would have been guilty of
murder. Exactly.
So but they have both ways.
But they have to find really that you believe that that was the case. They have to find that before you even get down below the level of murder.
Mm-hmm.
And then they address the issue, was it a reasonable or unreasonable belief?
Well, it cuts this way in this sense, is that you have the argument of justification, self-defense, all that now. And the jury has the cases either get you for first degree or let you off. And if they're sympathetic, you may get a hung jury or whatever, something, you know, one person just doesn't see giving you 20 years, right? So you may end up getting off. So it cuts the other way in that sense. Maybe you can find some people. All right. Okay, motion to move Amendment D. Any further discussion? Is there any objection? All right, all those in favor of the amendment, raise your right hand. All those opposed, same sign. Okay, the motion carries 6-1.
Okay, the next one, it's not going to be very...
Oh, Joe Vogler, on it.
Next one is not going to be controversial.
You want to bet the day went before you saw us, Barry?
Very little housekeeping.
Okay. Right, this just repeals the sections on assault and says, what this does is, on page 8, We define what serious provocation is for purposes of mitigating a murder to manslaughter. All the amendment does is on line 6 of the amendment, it adds the word sober, all right? So the guy that's intoxicated is not going to say, well, it was a serious provocation because I was intoxicated. It says it has to be a reasonable sober person, and it's...
Mr. Chairman, I think sober better instead say not a person not intoxicated.
Fine.
Because sober could mean that you're just a very, very...
You're a judge.
Yes.
You mean a reasonable, non-intoxicated person.
So, maybe that's not very artful.
That's what sober is. That's what sober may be. I know it sounds...
Well, sober has a whole bunch of other definitions.
You have to define it then.
Okay, I'll take care of it.
Now, I'm sorry, but tell me what this does.
Okay. We have a defense. I mean, the existing law and under the code, if you say, you know, I got killed under heat of passion, it mitigates it from murder to manslaughter. Okay. Now, in order to raise the defense, you have to prove that you acted under a serious provocation. This section defines serious provocation, and in defining it, it says that it's conduct that is sufficient to excite an intense passion in a reasonable person in the defendant's situation. Okay, in the defendant's situation. Well, that could be arguably interpreted to mean if he's intoxicated, you consider that in determining whether it was a serious provocation. The group felt that that was nonsense, that you should never consider that in determining whether it is a serious provocation. It should be considered as, you know, a reasonable person who's not intoxicated. and they felt that it may probably, it would perhaps be interpreted as that anyway, but they felt they should add it to exclude that argument.
What are you doing then? You're saying that a person who's intoxicated...
is judged but on
by the
basis
standards of the behavior of a sober person as to his reasonable beliefs and the kinds of responses that could result in provocation.
It's putting a higher standard in time. In other words, it's a, quote, law and order type thing.
In other words, he could...
Let me give you an example. I killed you, right? And I could argue, well, when I'm drunk, I'm easily provoked.
Right.
And we're saying, no, that doesn't matter. I mean, either you're provoked or not, it doesn't matter whether I was drunk or not.
Whether it's reasonable for you to be provoked is judged by the standards of a man who's sober.
Right.
Okay, but
the question is, was I provoked or not?
Yeah, I understand.
Understanding all the circumstances.
Are you also saying there's something that makes me uncomfortable about just not being
uncomfortable? Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
I would like to have a. I think just saying not intoxicated or something like that. That there's a drafting problem there, and I would hope that we would come back with the language somewhat artful, because should it even be broader than that? Should a person who is under the influence of some drug other than intoxicants...
Well, no, intoxicated would include... Okay, the way you got to do it is, when we go back to... We're coming up to intoxication. What we'll do is we'll define intoxication, include it as drug use...
Well, I was strung out on smack.
Oh, no,
the
no.
Guy was, you know.
It would be my understanding that sober would include the drug situation, but we'll do it so that it will.
Well, Mr. Chairman?
Mrs. Beck.
We also do it by just saying reasonable includes being sober.
Mr. Chairman, the reason for my response to Mrs. Rudd's suggestion there is that reasonable is a word you say for the jury. That's why you have 12 people sitting there who are supposed to take into account their 12 different life experiences as to what is really just what's the proper behavior for common sense human beings. And you don't ever try to subdivide reasonable or come up with a definition. That's for the jury to decide what is reasonable or not. So if we're plugging it in, I don't think we have to plug it in reasonable.
Okay, Mr.
Trash.
I'm really sorry. Something about it bothers me. Maybe it's that if we put drunk or sober in there, we also put, we could, should put sleeping or awake or
no.
On your birthday or not on your birthday or other things.
I do. And okay, now we could deal with this in another way. Don't add sober. We have a general provision in there that says, we'll get to it, intoxication is not a defense to a criminal charge. Okay, and I read that as meaning, sure, it's not a defense to a criminal charge, and just as long as it's not a defense, specifically not a defense here. And this may be something we could do in commentary, and just simply say, of course, no provision dealing with intoxication. The committee felt, this group felt, that you probably wouldn't be able to even make that argument here, you know, that you're judged on the basis of an intoxicated person. But yet they felt, well, throw it in, what could you lose? But your point being, of course, is that by specifically listing it, you know, maybe you're including, you see, and Lisa may be correct on that. That they may be more appropriately dealt with, number one, in commentary accompanying this provision and in commentary accompanying the section on intoxication.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think I agree. In the defendant's situation, under the circumstances as he reasonably believed them to be, in the defendant's situation, could then allow the defense attorney, and boy, if it's in there, I'd sure use it as a defense attorney, allow the defense attorney to argue to the judge for a jury instruction that in the defendant's situation means the theoretical reasonable person has had 11 tequilas, because that's the situation the defendant was in. So I don't think putting it in the commentary is going to make it. I think we have to do something in the direction of what this committee recommended to us. I think it's what we got in this proposed E is unartful. It ought to be a little broader than that. And maybe ask Barry to come back with another proposed
But you know, you got to decide whether you want to include anything in here.
And could we cross-reference the other section in here without putting the word intoxicated?
No. I think what you're going to need to do is say, a reasonable person who is not intoxicated, then we define intoxication as, intoxication includes intoxication from the use of alcohol or a drug. That's all you
do. I think that's good. And usually, like you always say, I'd rather have it in there than not. You'd be specific where you can. And in this sense, this is means that doesn't leave any doubt. Even though it may not cover as big an area as you could possibly go to, it covers the 99%.
It's awesome. Yes.
Yeah, but the thing I'm still groping towards is that if you list one sort of circumstance, then you are, by implication, leaving out other circumstances which may also pertain. Do you understand what I'm saying? If you don't list it, then you just, I suppose, leave it to the jury, well, he was drunk or not drunk.
You mean all but the other things that might
That might. We can't foresee.
That's so much my comment about not being controversial.
I suppose, Mr. Chairman,
maybe
what they're talking about can be addressed by his definition of intoxication or intoxicated. If it is so broad as to say voluntary impairment or something like that, because otherwise somebody's going to say that because you listed booze and heroin or impliedly narcotics, but not something else, that then you've got to assume that it's a person in the defendant's situation who was under this other voluntary impairment.
See, the only end result that's going to be is that what they were worried about is that somebody was going to use intoxication as an argument.
Yeah.
And we're preventing them from using intoxication.
As
now,
if
somebody, right, and if somebody else dreams up something else, maybe we can come back and correct it at that time. The only thing we'll be doing by not going further is letting them argue something that we haven't dreamed up.
That's right.
But we'll at least exclude intoxication as an argument. There may be other things that we should have excluded, but that we didn't because we didn't think of it. But I don't think it can hurt to exclude intoxication because we know we want that excluded.
Could you vote on the concept of including it? I think, frankly, all you need to say is a reasonable person, comma, who is not intoxicated. A reasonable person in the defendant's situation, comma, who is not intoxicated. Somewhere along there, put that in, and then define intoxication as intoxication includes intoxication from the use of alcohol or a drug. That's how it's defined in our existing law.
Okay, that covers
99.
Yeah, obviously, I haven't been able to put my finger on what's going on, and that's okay.
I'm going to move what he just said as an amendment so we have something before us since nobody can be here.
Is it possible to say something about, I've lost track as to whether we've eliminated this terminology, just another sentence saying it's not a defense that the defendant is
intoxicated? Well, it'll be hard to work out here. It would be really hard because we're talking about a defense to a prosecution,
yeah.
No, we're saying it's not a defense to, you know, we're dealing with a defense to begin with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I wish I could. It's an easy way to do it. But
I think the motion does.
Right, is there any objection to the amendment? The revised amendment
maybe, yes, sir.
Is
maybe,
a doctor
vote this way.
Of 6.5 AEDs.
Okay. Next one's not kind of personal either. page 9. If you just turn, it's probably easy just to turn to the bill. We define a person as alive on line 8 if, in the opinion of a medical doctor, whose license or exempt from licensing under that statute. The committee recommended simply knocking out, in the opinion of a medical doctor, up to the statute, the language.
So it's based on ordinary.
Yeah, because, I mean, you know, you get one medical doctor says the person's alive, that doesn't mean, you know, it should be governed by ordinary rules approved, you know, in a criminal trial.
Yeah.
Anyways.
That's if you bring in 1,000 doctors in a certain
fashion. So.
Well, yesterday you were complaining that only one doctor could commit a bank
robbery.
Well,
I see,
Mr.
Okay.
Yes, Mr. Drush.
Well, yeah, if we're going to do that, then what is the point of having a term based on ordinary standards of medical practice? I mean, it seems to me it might be the case that there either is or is not spontaneous.
Oh, I can't argue. I was thinking maybe going even further, you know, along those lines.
Alive, if there is spontaneous respiratory cardiac
right.
function.
I think that's. I don't think.
I mean, maybe I'm
all right. But I don't know, maybe, I can't see how it hurts to leave based on ordinary standards of medical practice in.
Because those
change,
and kidney machines and all that, I don't know, heart pacers.
All I know is that.
Well, the word spontaneous very precise in meaning. I mean, it either exists or it doesn't. It's either spontaneous or not. I mean,
yeah, but there's or there. There's or when respiratory or cardiac functions are maintained by artificial means, there is
spontaneous
brain
function. In other words, there has to be some kind of spontaneous function. And that's very precise. I mean, it either exists or it doesn't. So I would move to amend the amendment to a belief based on ordinary standards of medical practice.
Okay. Everybody has a motion that would read the person is alive if there is spontaneous respiratory, blah, blah, blah.
Oh, okay. I don't think that's a problem.
I think we may have to restructure it. Since that person is alive, he has spontaneous respiratory cardiac function. So, you know, it's
yes.
Somewhat funny.
As long as you're just changing language. Do you see a problem with
Yeah. Okay, is there any objection?
Yeah, I know what the definition means, but I don't know what ordinary standards of medical practice are. And if you were to leave it in, it would be the parade of lawyers going through and experts going through the... Yeah, because then you'd be arguing over what are or are not ordinary standards of medical practice. But if you delete it, the only thing you're arguing about are the rather objectively described standards in the rest of the sentence.
But the only question that you have... Is there a standard procedure in what people call a standard medical procedure to pronounce it from what are determined by the dead?
Well, here we're talking about lies.
The doctor just can't confirm it. He can come in and say, hey, that guy's dead. He has to standard test to determine.
How about, I have a suggestion. What about simply knocking out everything after ACT on line 8? And
get wrecked.
Means a human being was born and was alive at the time of the criminal act.
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
I'm all for leaving out this opinion of the medical doctor. I'll go along with
me. Okay.
Yeah, right. I just want
to
make sure.
Is there any objection then to the motion?
I will be amended amendment.
Mrs. Rudd moved
the motion. She's our whole thing. Yeah.
Is there any objection? Can it not vote the doctor as amended?
Okay, this really is a technical one. Amendment G. On page 11 of the bill, we have the term facilitate during the course of the kidnapping, the commission of a felony. This amendment simply knocks out during the course of the kidnapping. It's being inartful and it's unnecessary.
Yeah, that could be a nightmare.
Yeah. We also don't define a kidnapping. We don't refer to kidnapping.
Yeah. Is the motion been moved? And
yes.
G been moved? Is there any objection? No objection. Amendment is adopted.
Okay. No,
sex.
Now this is a biggie.
Okay. You actually didn't
turn.
Okay, let me preface this by saying this. Where everybody felt that we had changed things so much that there was going to be some real problems. In some way, but actually when we got done listening to all the complaints, the changes that Barry had to make to accomplish some of the things they did really didn't change what we wanted to do.
I'll go through each one.
Except I think it may have made it simpler. Okay.
Mr. Chairman, I spent some time at the beginning of the meeting. You made very close. Unusually silent because I was trying to understand what had been done for this section. And there are two requests I'd like to make. One is that you go through, before we deal with what's here, tell me what the problems were that were delineated. And the second request I'd like to make is that we not act on this subject. I really need to find it again. I think it's maybe more far-reaching than you think it is if it's not. So I need lots of time. So I ask your indulgence on that.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, in light of the time, could we just, if Mrs. Rudd wants to do that, could we vote on the amendments other than the things involving sexual offenses and then just take them up by themselves? Maybe also at the time we're considering sentencing or whatever.
It'd be very nice to finish the substance, the non-sentencing provisions. I could start writing the commentary to it. Just get this over with. I mean, it's... No, I'm not saying...
Maybe I will by the end, but I don't think so.
I think we're going to find it's not... Okay. Just in terms of, without looking at the statute, The group was concerned about two things. First of all, they were concerned about the effect of the sexual assault provisions on activity that that occurs every day, and that is sexual contact between people that are under 18. And the committee, the group felt that that should be criminal, but it shouldn't be treated as a sexual assault. And they said, let's treat it as contributing. Let's not treat it as a sexual assault. When you say, for example, a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old engage in sexual contact, consensual, you know, they're dating and they may be petting, but that shouldn't be viewed as a sexual assault. It should be contributing. The other thing that they were concerned about was that we define sexual contact very broadly. And under the provisions of the bill, if two people are in a drive-in and there's a boy and a girl, and the boy attempts to fondle the breast of the woman, and he's pushed away and he continues, he's guilty of a B felony. And the committee felt that you should distinguish between sexual assaults, short of penetration, that are serious sexual assaults, and others that aren't as serious, and we attempted to do so. The important thing to note, and it bears mention, because I don't think we've gone over it really this year, is that we define sexual penetration extremely broadly. It includes any penetration and conduct which would arguably not be rape under existing law would be included within our first degree sexual assault provision under sexual penetration. Well, the digital manipulation, for example, when there is penetration.
That means using hands, not computer.
I don't think so.
I think it is.
It's not rape.
Any penetration, however slight.
Yeah,
that's
but
in present law.
I don't, well,
that's
I don't.
That's a definition out of the Uniform Code of Military Justice. It's not out of the Alaska statute.
No, that's not correct. I believe Lisa's right, but I believe, Lisa, that it is, I don't think that it's questionable whether it would be interpreted as including the digital act.
Well, okay. And if it's not, it shouldn't.
Okay. I agree. Well, it's covered in the code. There's no question about it. It's covered
in the
code.
This isn't a proposal to change.
No, we're not.
But I think it's in present law,
okay.
And that's one of the things that concerns me about reading this, is that I think we're retreating from some of the things that are in present law, aside from what's in
No, we still treat that as, we still treat that as penetration.
Digital?
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
well,
that's not.
Only what have you done to it?
Nothing. We haven't changed anything about sexual penetration. The only, well, I don't want to go into change, let me just put policy things. The other thing was, in terms of our concern about mentally incapacitated people, mentally defective, the group felt that we should be a little more artful in referring to that crime. So what we did is we specified the culpability requirement of the actor. Essentially, you have to know the person is mentally defective. It is not, you know, it's not strict liability. For example, you have to know that the person is suffering from a mental disorder, and that's going to get the situation where you're having the attendant abusing patients in the mental hospital, because he's going to know that that person's incapable of consenting. The other thing was, we covered specifically sexual contact with, say, mentally defective people and intoxicated people. The committee felt that that should be treated as an assault, because we treat it as an A misdemeanor, and that's, if there's any type of physical injury involved, it would be an assault under the code. But that should not be viewed as a sexual offense. And frankly, I don't think we're going to have too many incidents of, say, sexual contact that falls short of penetration with a person that is, say, mentally defective. It's unlikely to occur and recurring to be prosecuted under the general assault provisions. Another change was the committee did not like the indecent exposure statute. They felt, number one,
they didn't spend much time on that one, though, did they?
Yeah, well, but there was a unanimous recommendation on that. One other thing. Another thing was that in incest, we had a very, Chief Barkley pointed this out, that the way we treated incest in the bill was originally drafted, we came down very severe on it, in the sense that we came in with a proposal that said consensual incest between people over 18 is legal. And on the other hand, we came down in a provision that said, however, if you are related in any way, you're going to be treated very seriously. Well, now that we criminalize consensual incest, it lets us more appropriately look at cases where it should be an aggravating factor of rape, which the amendment does. In other words, we went overboard in treating incestuous conduct as sexual assault, because if we didn't treat it as sexual assault, it wouldn't be treated anywhere. Well, now we have it treated. We have it treated as a C felony in the bill.
So the recommendation is put all incest as incest.
No, not true. Not all. There's
well,
be consistent
okay,
with existing
with
law. If it's your son or your
under 13.
Yeah. No, that's not correct. That's not correct. If it's under 18, and it's your son or your daughter, but previously we said if it's under 18, it's your niece or something. Now, that's still covered, but it's not going to be covered as a VA felony. The other thing was is that what we did is we, again, I mentioned to you, sexual contact with a person between 13 and 16 is not treated as a sexual assault. It's treated as contributing. The penalty for it is going to be the same. It's going to be any misdemeanor. It just felt that should not be viewed as a sexual assault.
Wait a minute. By an adult of someone between 13 and 16?
Yeah, that's consensual. That's consensual. We didn't change the penalty. We simply treated it as contributing.
Well, that certainly changes what we have now. If a child 16 or under cannot give consent. Now we're saying that between 13 and 16, they can have, they can consent.
No, we don't. We say that if the child...
What does consensual mean?
The bill does not change anything.
It means you didn't threaten or coerce.
Yes. Yes, the amendment says that, the amendment doesn't change any of the penalties. It simply says that when you're dealing with children between 13 and 16, and it's consensual, it's still an offense, and it's still an AA misdemeanor, but it's called contributing. Well.
I need time to think these things.
You want me to go through with Section Mason?
Okay, well, do you want time to look at it and we'll bring it up later?
I think we've had delays and all, but... You know, this is,
I'm willing to discuss it more. I don't want to.
Okay, do you not want to vote on it today?
I'd rather not vote on it today.
I don't think we'll get to any of the other amendments if we work on this today.
I think you're going to find, frankly, I understand your concern, and I really think that when you sit down and look through it,
maybe I could spend some time with you.
Yeah, I think that's important.
If we're not going to vote on it today, then it probably would be faster to let everybody read it and think about it for a while.
Yeah. Okay, can you turn the page to 13? Great. Unlawful exploitation of a minor. Page 13, Amendment K.
Of the amendment.
Oh.
Okay.
Is all that under 6?
Yeah. Now, when you go through it, I'd really like everyone to go through it because it affects the indecent exposure statute as well as. No one had any problems with that.
Really?
No one had any problems with that.
After all that controversy, they didn't have any problems.
If you do all of this, I can understand
how. That.
So what we've got to study between now and the next meeting is H through J, right?
Yeah, right.
Pages 8 through 12. Okay, all we did here is on lines 12, 14, and 6, we added the word obscene. The reason being is that this arguably made a B felony for a teacher to put on Romeo and Juliet in the schoolhouse, and it was everyone was unanimous.
Hey,
wait a minute. What? Schoolhouse teachers, Romeo and Juliet, they got all our attention now.
The only amendments here, again, is on page on line 12, line 14, and line 6. We added obscene. Another reason is that if you had a picture, if someone took a picture of a mother breastfeeding her child, without the obscene, you know, we originally said the touching by another person, I'm sorry, the touching of another person's genitals, anus, or female breast. We made it a B.
What page are we on? What amendment is
Page 15 and 18.
No, page 13.
All right.
13 of the amendments.
Page 13, the numbers are down on the bottom.
We want amendment K.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, in the fest line. I'm sorry, page 15 of the bill. That's right, Ed. I'm
okay.
But all it does, if you turn to the amendment on
just
page...
just adds three times the word obscene.
And really what it does is, though, it's only two times because in number 6 on line 18, we originally had lewd. The group thought that lewd was fairly meaningless and we shouldn't use the word obscene there.
We don't.
The Supreme Court decides what obscene is.
And what did they decide?
They said that they can't define
local
obscene,
standard.
But they know it when they're
saying. We're talking about our court, though. We're talking about our court. Our Alaska Supreme Court. They haven't, because we don't have an obscenity statute, so they're going to have a few cases here. But I want you to know that unless you add obscene here, what it says...
The whole thing may be struck down.
Not only that, but what you're saying is that you cannot take a picture in this state of a mother breastfeeding her child. That you're making them, not only that, you're making it a B felony.
That's a good example, and also Romeo and Juliet's a good example, but let's face it, that's not going to be prosecuted.
Oh, it might. I
well, you can't draft the bill. You can't draft a statute in this area that arguably covers that, because it'll be struck down. It's not, you know.
Okay, now that's more of an argument.
Well,
that's the fact that, somebody's going to...
You actually, you want to have the recommendation of the group actually was, this is totally unconstitutional. Some felt more, they just laughed at it mostly, but... They said, mostly they said, well, we ought to just leave it because it's unconstitutional anyway, and it's going to get thrown out.
Well, Terry, I think it should be pointed out that this is dealing with the exploitation. The next page was the one they laughed at.
Well, no, it isn't.
Oh, this one too.
Well, now, is there any other terms? What do you lawyers on?
No.
Besides obscene, now, because you know what the argument is. I'm going around and talking to people about obscene. There's not a judge or lawyer in this county can tell you what obscene is.
That's
why put a word in here that's not anybody including the
okay, you want to add lewd? We could add lewd too, that's fine.
Mr. Chairman,
the lewd now is, that's the kind of word I'm looking for. Can you define what lewd is?
No.
Mr. Chairman, we're stuck.
I think
Mr. Chairman, I think we're stuck, and I think that if you like, the few people in the committee who are willing to offer any views on how to say this are probably right. If we don't put in something, you know, the word that is being used, that's being litigated, and is being defined in the cases, is obscene. If we use another word, lewd or something else like that, then if anything, there'll be more litigation than necessary. There's already been a course of litigation with regard to what the meaning of that word is. And I think it may even save the second constitutional.
The only changes are in like 12, 14, and 6. Nothing else has changed there.
18.
And 18.
Yeah, 12, 14, and 18.
And we used to have lewd there.
I certainly will go for the amendment.
I think that the situation is the no word's good enough. Seems probably better than others because it's had more.
There's been a course of about 10 years of litigation over what that word means. There haven't been any cases lately over what lewd means. Because there was one case on lewd and lascivious, but minus the lascivious. You know, what is it? And I think lewd and lascivious are pretty ancient, silly words.
Well, in 5 years, they'll be saying that about us.
Well,
what if we just, you know, what's left to say? No, this is another one of those things that's going to sit on the books forever.
Frankly, I think what's left of the statute is the statute is left. You know, because you've got, number one, if you get right, number one, four, and five, on line 12, 16, and 17, there's no obscene there. I mean, the determination is simply that any kid engaging in sexual penetration, masturbation, bestiality, there's no legitimate reason to do that.
What? There's got to be an obscene, why don't we define obscene?
I could request legislative affairs to do that, and we'd come back with a definite. I think that would be a big mistake, frankly. I think you should simply leave it up to the courts.
Yeah,
our court to decide.
Yeah, they haven't done it.
But we don't have an obscenity statute. How are they going to do it?
Well, let's define obscene.
They haven't done it in the United States.
I don't. I do not have the wisdom of Solomon. Maybe the novelist over there does.
Well, no, I don't understand. We're saying we're going to solve a problem by using a word that nobody knows what it means. Now that's absurd.
Well, all we know is it doesn't include taking a picture of your wife, breastfeeding her child. That's clear.
Okay.
And it's true. I have trouble telling what obscene means, but I know it doesn't cover the example I just gave you. You know, and you don't want the statute. I mean, it's not good to have a statute like this laughed at. You know, and that's what's going to happen. I mean, if you turn to the next page. Is originally drafted this transportation or distribution section prohibit the sale of the Bible in Alaska.
Okay, Mrs. Red.
Well, I want to respond to Bill's concern because I have the same concern, but the problem is that we're getting into the whole area of what's in the eye of the beholder. And I wrote to Russ Freeman in Anchorage, who runs the book Cassius in Anchorage, when we first got this section way back in January. Because I was concerned about his response. He's always opposed any kind of censorship, any kind of limiting. And he sent me back some books that have some paintings by a guy, which I think, I'm not sure I'd describe them in my mind as obscene. Some people would think they're obscene. I think they're just kind of disgusting. Other people think they're art. I mean, they really do think they are art. And that's why it's so hard to determine what obscene means, and I think it's safer to leave it to the court because of this reason. Times change and society's view of things changes. And what the courts, as far as I can recollect, have done over the years is try to make some determination on what the general standards of the community where this thing occurred are. And if it's out of sync with those standards, then it's obscene. If it's in sync, it's not.
Okay, well then, if that's the problem, can't we define it like we define some of the other things? A reasonable person
Well, that is the next suggestion.
Yes, okay.
Maybe I'm not making a good suggestion here, but what we're talking here about is the same kind of thing when we're talking about indecent exposure. Could we say instead the indecent exposure of another person's or the indecent touching of, and we could pick up that definition from the indecent exposure of, with reckless disregard.
We don't use that anymore, number one. And I think that is, in the reckless disregard, you talk about a constitutional type thing, that's probably why we're knocking out. I mean, it's so vague. I mean, it's so difficult in this area. And Randy Phillips Bill originally did have an obscenity thing in there. He did not have just across the board prohibition. It's not like it's...
Board? That doesn't even sound possible. We made an agreement, and I said, we knew all these arguments. These are not new arguments. They've been going on for years, but we were going to test and let the Supreme Court rule whether we could deal with children, 16 and under, whether they're 13, 16. Now, that was a test that I wanted to make. Rather than us make the decision that the Supreme Court would say that we can't deal with children.
This is not dealing with the question. I know what you're heading at.
Chairman, there was some kind of a deal made. I wasn't part of it.
It doesn't deal with what you're bringing up. Ed. The statute is drafted, again, applies to me taking a picture of my wife breastfeeding her kid. And it makes me a B felon, if I put that in a book and I distribute that and I call it, you know, the joys of motherhood. I would be guilty of a B felony here.
You won't be guilty of a lot of these laws if you take a girl with that driving you're talking about.
No.
You know,
if
somebody wants to go back.
Well, there's a law like that, then we should change that. But all I'm saying is that, again, you know, that's a fairly powerful argument why you want to have that obscene provision in there. And leave it up to the courts.
Let me get that one question. I understand what you're talking about. I'm sure you know what you're talking about from the law standpoint. But why can't a state legislature sit down and say what's obscene?
Oh, you can. And I said, if you'd like me to... I can.
We can't.
Why not?
Because we can't think of everything that might be obscene. And if we leave it out, then it's unobscene.
Well, what is that one that the Supreme Court said something about that offends a normal person in a community or they had some
normal
kind of standard
redeeming social value?
Yeah, and lack of social value and redeeming social value. I mean, they had one somewhere in the court.
Yeah, but it changes that every year.
Mr. Chairman, the course of cases on this thing over the last 15 years has been
up or down, kids. Let's go on that.
I think we'd be really, we would be postponing passing anything for 5 years if we started arguing over the definition of obscenity.
We sure would.
All right.
I guess I have to go along with you guys, the legal brains, but it's your, you know.
I'll tell you what my position is, that, you know, Ed, if you like it without it in there, it isn't going to bother me, but I'm never going to be the guy that stands up and defends these things as being constitutional or wonderful or anything else. I'll say this is the committee's will, which I said this weekend.
I don't want to ride into this code something that's vague, and that's the only reason to redo it.
Yeah, that's it. And
the proposed amendment may save much of the statute constitutional. Move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Okay, the amendment was moved. Is there any objection?
Okay. Just for the record, I'm going to object.
Okay, there's an objection. Okay. Mr. Decker objects to obscenity. Motion carries.
Look, on the next page, the same... this is the same amendment with the obscene there, but the only difference is here is on line 10, we say that depicts, then we added the word by means other than words, because depiction includes written depiction.
Which, of course, was...
Which we prohibited the Bible.
And the Oxford OED edition. Where are we now?
Page 14 of the amendment.
Page 14? Word 14, Amendment L.
Well, I've got page 79, Amendment L.
Well,
I'm sorry. Okay.
The numbers are down the bottom.
Well, I keep talking about numbers in there.
Oh. Yeah, okay.
Okay, we passed K already?
Yeah. Again, the only difference, the only change here is we added by means other than words and the same scene.
That's exactly
well.
I move the amendment, Mr. Chairman.
Has everybody got the right place now? Amendment L, it's on page 79 of the bill, line 10 there, by means of the word.
Is there a motion?
I move the amendment.
Okay, is a motion to adopt Amendment L? Is there any objection? Okay, the motion to adopt. Okay.
Sure.
Next one is on page 15.
Okay, the next Amendment M. Page 34 of the bill.
Terry, this was something everybody, I believe, was unanimous on. The criminal possession of forgery device, as originally drafted, it turned to page 34 of the committee, really now the committee substitute, I guess, the post-committee substitute. We had on lines 12 to 15, you're guilty of the offense if you possess with knowledge of its character any device, equipment, or article specifically designed for use in counterfeiting or otherwise forging written instruments. Problem with that is that it, even though you never intended to use the device for forging the written instruments, or it may have been in like an antique slot machine, or you know you had it on your wall, you would be guilty of the offense. This requires that you intend to use it, or aid or permit another to use it, in order to be guilty of the offense.
Well, wait a minute. But you said slot machine.
I thought you told me that we'd take care of antique slot machines.
This were our forgery devices. Now I was giving the comparison.
That's not an example. Forgery's not slot machine.
No. I was giving the example. The problem was that in slot. This has nothing to do with slot machines. It's simply forging devices.
In other words, I could find one from 1889 that's just beautiful and could
be. Exactly.
Okay. Amendment M. Is motion to be made?
I'll move it.
Is there any objection? Yeah, motion is adopted.
Okay, Barry, just one question if I can ask about that. You didn't say in here that a lot of plates and dyes and other things that you can have those in your possession now.
That's the important thing about the amendment. You have to prove an intent to use or to aid another to use it for purpose of forgery. It doesn't get, if you happen to have ink in your house, you're not in violation of the statute.
We're not talking about ink, we're talking about plates and stuff.
Well, it says apparatus, other devices, that can include ink.
Guys.
Right, it was much too broad.
This is very similar to an antique
spot. Well, dye. That's not what we're talking about. That's D-Y-E. This is something else. A dye is a mold.
A D-I-E
is a mold. A
D-Y-E
is ink.
Oh, that's not it. Yeah, okay. Well, okay. No.
I think other device apparatus would include ink anyway. Okay.
Terry,
if I had a bad sale of Bibles.
Yeah.
If I had my home and die set up, or if we get me with a guy that makes the last driver's license, and it'll run off labor where you get up here and you need the resident car. And I've got a nice machine that dies all set to make the last resident car for driver's license. And the police catch me with it, I've got a complete setup to run these off. That's legal.
No.
Well, it's legal unless they can prove that you intended.
So you intended to use it or aid another to use it for purpose of forgery. Now, you got to decide. I mean, you could...
The die itself would be enough to show anything.
Well, all right. Now, that's what the bill is drafted. I mean, the committee substitute is drafted. It says you got the die or the plate or any other device that is specifically designed for forging, you're going to be guilty of the crime regardless of your intent. Mere possession. Now, it was felt that you should have a specific type of intent requirement here, an attempt to defraud or whatever. Your point, of course, being, well, why do you have that license plate thing in your house? Well, the thing is, arguably the statute covers more than that, and it's conceivable you may have something that's specifically designed for forging thing, and you don't intend to use it. It's simply, you know, it's just antique or whatever, and you've got it in your house.
Or you're a police officer.
And I would think that, oh, you're a police officer, that's right. And the thing is that I think that if you find that in your basement and you've got, you know, the die for licenses, I think it's going to be very easy to show that you intended to use or to aid another use it for purposes of forgery.
Yeah.
I don't think the intent requirement is...
The jury will get an instruction on circumstantial evidence, and what they'll really do is they'll take into account the mere possession and say, what if God's green earth reason was he can be had this, but it's hardly a collector's item or anything like that.
Is that
no, I don't think you could
have it. Well, under our section, I could get you for having ink unless we amend it.
All right. Yeah.
Thanks for the information on dye.
Okay, is there any
ink that dye?
Well, I thought dye meant in terms of like an ink, you know, some kind of red dye.
Special U.S. currency. Okay, is there any objection in the room?
Yes, I have a question.
Why'd
you drop that?
Excuse me. Counterfeit?
Well, on line 12, is that an arduous character? Why was that taken out?
Well, because now it has the intent requirement in it. I don't think it's necessary. In other words, you got intent to use it or to aid another to use it, so it's implied. I'm sorry to point that out.
Sure.
Yeah.
Chairman, I don't know how many more you're going to try, but we're not going to make them through here today, because at least Mr. Carpenter and I have some problems with the provisions about firearms that I mentioned to you on Saturday. We have no proposed amendment on here.
Well, you didn't speak to
me. I spoke to Terry about it, and I thought I did speak to you, Barry, about it. And so even if we pass all these amendments, we're not going to make it all the way through.
Okay.
And I, among others, I've been going constantly before 10 this morning. I got a meeting to chair in 2 hours, and it'll be useless for if we go much longer.
Mr. Chairman, do you think, if we have a few more minutes left, could I take the ones that are very, I think, that are relatively short, and kind of go through those, and go for another 10 minutes, Mr. Chairman?
Okay, we won't go for another hour.
Okay, well, I'm going to have to leave in about 10 minutes.
Okay. Let me quickly turn to page 18.
You're going to go for another hour?
Okay.
No.
Well, when you guys leave, then we're done.
I've
got to run
for another meeting.
Okay.
What is this?
Okay, 18.
All right, let's go. Page 18.
One more. Okay, turn to Amendment P, which is marked 18 at the bottom of your page.
Look, all this does, it says... All this is just a technical amendment. It simply says that yes, on page 18. All it says is that the provisions on culpability only apply to the criminal code. It felt that we should have a specific reference in the statute to it is instead of a provision in a temporary bill. It's a very...
Okay.
Is there a motion?
I so move.
Is there any objection? There's no... Amendment P is enough.
Okay, just turn to the next page.
Q, Amendment Q.
Okay, you should turn to page 39 of the bill. The committee was unanimous in its recommendation, although the Attorney General at least favored it. I don't know whether Dan did or not, but this is to knock out criminal usury as an offense, and it knocks out the crime of criminal usury and the crime of possession of usurious loan records.
Was this the problem that then you could never get a civil penalty because you couldn't get the civil evidence because somebody could always plead the Fifth Amendment?
Yeah, not only could they plead the Fifth Amendment, but it was simply felt that if you've got a loan shark, you go after him for extortion or assault. You don't have to rely on this. Number two, we don't have any provisions on criminal usury now. It's all dealt with civilly, and no one saw any reason why it should be a specific provision in the criminal code.
You mean,
yeah,
okay.
I agree.
Yeah,
I did too.
Right. Yeah, one thing I'd forgotten about that they raised, I was here, I've been part of this on Saturday.
It's an excellent.
And that was the...
Here.
That was the problem.
We'll
that take over, and somebody has an excuse to give you no evidence in the civil.
Chairman, there's no vice chairman.
Fred,
I'm chairman. Okay. We have got a motion with regard to the usury thing. Okay, any objection? Amendment Q is passed.
Okay, turn to page 23 of the amendment. Amendment S. This affects page 46 of the bill, which is endangering the welfare of a minor in the second degree. The committee was unanimous on this. They felt that the conduct described there should be treated as an assault. If it wasn't an assault, it should simply be dealt with through civil proceedings against the parents, and that this statute shouldn't be in the criminal law. The example being of the mother, the neighbor who doesn't like the way the mother's treating the kid.
Mrs.
Ryan?
What kind of
amendment
is that? The definition of assault. I mean,
yeah.
I thought assault had to be physical. Doesn't you just leave somebody somewhere and have to assault?
Well, when I say assault, I include reckless endangerment there. And reckless endangerment, which says you recklessly engage in conduct which exposes the person to a substantial risk of a serious physical injury. You don't have to actually cause any injury. And
that's different from...
Yes, that is correct. This is a lesser standard. There's no question about it. This in the bill. But it was felt that if it didn't reach the level of assault, that the criminal law shouldn't get involved and should deal with it civilly. And people were unanimous on that. You've already cut back the statute, in a previous amendment. We used to have the statute on cruel confinement, cruel punishment. And again, it was felt that this stuff should be dealt with by going.
If we're willing to write a physical injury standard rather than a serious physical injury, assault, I could go for it. But I think we ought to cover just the risk of physical injury rather than serious physical injury.
Well, the problem also being, at least, is that it's the term physical injury is so broad that any time you have a statute that arguably allows a prosecution where you leave your kid in the car for 2 minutes while you go to, you know, you go to the store, that would be too broad.
You're talking about substantial risk.
Yeah. Well,
and children, as a matter of fact, have died in cars when they've been left.
Well, then that's serious physical injury.
Yeah, I know, but I mean, the fact is, there is a substantial risk when you leave a child in a car sometimes, because they can take the brake off.
Isn't that serious physical injury they're being exposed to under those circumstances?
Well, that's the point. I mean, if we delete this section, then you have not committed a crime.
Oh, yeah, but if it's...
Mr. Chairman, with regard to this amendment, which is proposed Amendment S, it is controversy has arisen, so I suggest that we bring it up again. Maybe I'll end up agreeing with the little committee after I look at it further. Right now, I'm drifting in the direction of those questions.
With
us.
Unless you want to...
Do you guys need to go right now?
We got one little short one left somewhere.
You
want
to turn to littering?
Barry, the thing that Larry and I are concerned about...
It's not, believe me, it's not...
Fairbanks gun people.
But I looked through it and I... How are you?
Okay, we'll go. I'll point out everything that's changed.
I have comments.